Another one of my old Christmas presents from years gone by was one of those photo mosaic jigsaws. I don't know if you've ever seen one of them. They're pretty amazing. I can't fathom the genius of them myself. They're pretty mind-boggling things. But for those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, they're jigsaws where each individual piece has a photo of something. So mine was a lion jigsaw. Each individual piece had a photo of a lion on it. And then as you put the jigsaw together and put all these photos together, then you take a step back and the different shades of the different photographs on each individual piece make the face of a lion. So you step back and you see the big picture quite literally when you take a step back from the jigsaw. And I think what Isaiah does in this passage we're going to be considering together, which is verses 6 to the end of this chapter 2 of Isaiah, what he does is a similar thing. He zooms in, as it were, to the individual piece, as it were, the small picture, in verses 6 to 9. And he examines the nation of Israel at that time, that nation that God has spent so much of the Old Testament dealing with, and we hear so much about them there. And he looks, as it were, at how they're getting on, how Israel are getting on. And we get a bit of an insight into Israel's perspective on life, what Israel's worldview is like, how they think life should be lived, and what they do at that time. And then, having done that, he takes a step back. He zooms out, as it were, and gives us a much broader perspective. A perspective which includes God. A perspective which includes the day of the Lord, which we'll come on to think about. He paints in broader strokes, and he gives us the big picture of the universe. He gives us a perspective which Israel don't have at this time. And so I want us to consider these two perspectives, if we can, this morning. Firstly, looking at Israel, and what I'll just call for the sake of ease, the Israel perspective, and then zooming out and looking at the true perspective of the universe in the second half of the chapter. And I want us to think, while we consider these things, well, which is my perspective? When I look at the universe, the way I live my life, does it reflect this Israel perspective, or does it reflect the true perspective, the big perspective, which Isaiah described? So I hope that makes sense, and we'll begin by looking at the Israel perspective and zoom in, and let's look at what Israel was like at this time in verses 6 to 9. And on the face of it, Israel's situation is pretty good, really. If we look at verse 7, we read that their land is full of silver and gold. There's no end to their treasures. They're going through a time of great prosperity, with great riches, and also a time of military strength. The horses and the chariots that it refers to is often used in the Old Testament as this symbol of Israel's might, Israel's military strength and prowess. And so, well, things look pretty rosy, and even a cursory glance at verse 6 tells us that, well, at the very least, then they had good relations with the nations around them, which is something which couldn't be said for a lot of Israel's history, as you may know. They were clasping hands with pagans. Well, at least they were getting on with them. There was peace with nations around them. So on the surface, pretty good, really. Pretty rosy for Israel. So what was the problem? Because there is a problem, isn't there? Isaiah says at the beginning of verse 6, "You have abandoned your people, the house of Jacob." It seems that God has abandoned his people. But things are still pretty rosy for them. So what's going on here? Well, it's only when we remember who these people are in the light of God's relationship with them throughout the Old Testament that we begin to see the cracks appearing beneath the surface of this pleasant veneer of Israel's situation. We remember that these are a people that God had made great promises to, wonderful promises throughout the Old Testament. We'll turn and look at just a couple of them in If you turn back with me to Leviticus and chapter 26, not somewhere I've turned to in sermons much before, but Leviticus 26. I'm sorry, I don't have the number in the church Bible, which probably would have helped you, but we'll read verse 6 and see one of the promises there and then another in verse 9. Leviticus 26 and verse 6, God says to the Israelites, I will grant peace in the land, and you will lie down, and no one will make you afraid. I will remove savage beasts from the land, and the sword will not pass through your country. So a promise of peace in the land to the Israelites. And then in verse 9, I will look on you with favor and make you fruitful and increase your numbers, and I will keep my covenant with you. You will still be eating last year's harvest when you will have to move it out to make room for the new. So not only peace, but prosperity as well. God had promised them these things, and yet there was a condition to these promises. And we see that in verse 3 of the same chapter. If you look back there, these promises are prefixed with an if. If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands. We see an example of one of God's decrees in verse 1. Do not make idols or set up an image or a sacred stone for yourselves. If they obeyed God's commands, well then God promised them great peace in their land and prosperity. God had given them great promises, but the people of Israel at this time, well, rather than trusting God, rather than trusting his promises for them, they were looking elsewhere. They were looking to other places other than God. God had promised peace and prosperity on the condition of obedience, but instead they'd chosen disobedience. And they were seeking security not from God, but from the silver and the gold, from their treasures, from their horses, from their chariots. This is where they were seeking their peace and their prosperity. They weren't trusting God's promises, but looking elsewhere, looking to these things to keep them safe and prosperous. That was the Israel perspective, a perspective with no reference to God, a perspective which cuts God out of the picture, which says, I don't need God. I don't need God. I'm not trusting him. Is this our perspective this morning? Is this how we live our lives? It's perhaps quite hard to tell. Is it, well am I trusting God? Am I living like that? Do I have the Israel perspective? Well, how do we know? How do we know if we're living like this? Well, just to help us, I think these verses, they give us a few symptoms, if you like, that will appear on the surface if this is our perspective, a few kind of signs that indicate that this might be how we view life. And so I want us just to look at a couple of them briefly. The first, well, in verse 6, we read that the Israelites are full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines and clasp hands with pagans. The nation of Israel, they'd absorbed the culture of the world around them. They didn't look, as we've already said, to God, to his standards, to obey. But rather, they just looked to the general consensus. Well, what's everyone else doing? Let's have a look around. Well, divination, okay, we'll have some of that. Superstitions from the east, well, that seems to be okay for them. We'll go with that. What's the general consensus about how we should behave? What does society say? Well, that's okay then. We'll go with that. One of the symptoms of having the Israel perspective, is that indicative of, do you see that symptom in your life at all? Do you pay regards to what God says about how you should live your life? Do you listen to his warnings, to his promises, to his commands? Or is kind of the general consensus, what society says, what the media says, is that okay for you? You settle for that, cut God out of the picture, go with the flow of the rest of society. Well, that's one of the symptoms. A second symptom, maybe, that we can pick up on. There's this preoccupation that the Israelites have with things, with stuff, with objects, with possessions. Their land's full of silver and gold. There's no end to their treasures. Their land's full of horses. There's no end to their chariots. They had these things in abundance, and they got their security. They put their trust in these things. They were so preoccupied with these things, it seems. And do we see symptoms of this in our lives? I guess horses and chariots aren't so valuable to us these days. But perhaps it's when you just have to buy that DVD or that book that's going in the sale, not because you're going to watch it more than once, not because you're going to get beyond the first chapter, but because it's got to be on your shelf, it's got to be part of your collection, it's got to be there, it's got to be yours. That might perhaps be a symptom, or perhaps it's this preoccupation with things when it feels like your month has been completely ruined because you've accidentally taped over the Strictly Come Dancing final or your favourite TV programme, whatever that might be. Obviously, I guess BBC iPlayer could really help you out with that these days, but do you get that feeling? Do you see that symptom in your life? Or is it that your life at work revolves around the principle that the next pay rise will be enough? Just the next one, then I can live comfortably if I get the next pay rise, if I just make it that far. Do we see any of these symptoms in our lives? These could be symptoms of the Israel perspective, cutting God out of the picture, paying no reference to him. And at the root of all of this is pride. We see that very clearly. Verses 8 and 9. Their land is full of idols. They bow down to the work of their hands, to what their fingers have made. So man will be brought low and mankind humbled. Do not forgive them. Israel was worshipping idols. Seems to be a regular theme in the Old Testament. But why was it? Was it because they believed these idols had any particular power or particular attractiveness or beauty? Well, no. Isaiah makes it clear the reason that they're worshipping these idols is because they'd made them, because they were the work of their hands, because they're what their fingers had made. In worshipping these idols, they are effectively worshipping themselves, worshipping their own work. We worship these idols because we've made them. And we want to be those who make our own gods. Pride is at the root of this. And Isaiah condemns their pride. It almost sounds quite harsh. I wonder if you kind of flinched when you heard verse 9 read to us. So man will be brought low and mankind humbled. Do not forgive them. Isaiah takes so seriously this perspective. He takes it so seriously. It's unforgivable. How can Israel think like this? How can they cut God out of the picture? How can they be so full of pride? So much for the Israel perspective. Is that our perspective this morning? Do you see those symptoms in your life? Are you someone who cuts God out of the picture? Well, let's move on. Let's move on to the true perspective, the broader perspective, as Isaiah takes a step back and takes God into account and particularly focuses on this day that is coming sometime in the future. He talks about it so often in these verses, 10 to the end of the chapter. Verse 11, in that day. Verse 12, the Lord Almighty has a day in store. Verse 17, in that day. Verse 20, in that day. There is this day coming. And Isaiah can't stop talking about it as he takes this step back. He sees this day approaching. And he talks about it again and again and again. And what's going to happen on that day? Well, whilst it does seem like quite a long stretch of verses 10 to 22, there is, as you may have seen when we read, lots of repeated themes. And there's a central thrust to what Isaiah is saying about what will happen on that day. It's repeated in verse 11 and then again in verse 17. What will happen on that day? Well, Isaiah says, the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. That's the day that's coming. The day which Isaiah sees in the future is rushing up on Israel and on all of mankind, this day when God alone will be exalted and glorified. And if we're to have a broad perspective on our lives, on the world, on the way we should live, then we need to acknowledge this, that there is this day coming when God alone will be exalted. Isaiah sees it coming. Do we see it coming? The Bible calls it elsewhere a day of judgment. It's that day it describes when Jesus Christ will return and judge the whole world. He'll return as Lord and as evidently as King and ruler of the universe, the one to whom all authority and power has been given. And let's consider then, how is it that God will be exalted in that day? If this is a day when the Lord alone will be exalted, well, more precisely, what's going to happen? Well, two actions, I think, that Isaiah talks about in this passage that will take place on that day. Two actions. Firstly, God's great glory will be put on display for all to see. If God alone is to be exalted on that day, then his glory is going to be put on display for all to see. Isaiah refers to it, verse 10, as the splendor of God's majesty, the splendor of his majesty on display for all to see. The glory of God. How can we begin to describe what that will be like? The Bible goes some way, doesn't it? Bible writers try to illustrate what that will be like. They talk about God being one who dwells in unapproachable light and the beauty of holiness, a God who is a consuming fire. They compare his glory to the works of creation, the world that we see around us. The heavens declare the glory of God, the psalmist says. They give us a taster of what God's glory at the splendor of his majesty is like. But ultimately, something that's beyond description. Isaiah helps us as well to understand a bit of what it will be like, I think. If we read verses 12 to 17 and think about them for a moment. The Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted, and they will be humbled. For all the cedars of Lebanon, tall and lofty, and all the oaks of Bashan. For all the towering mountains and all the high hills, for every lofty tower and every fortified wall, for every trading ship and every stately vessel, the arrogance of man will be brought low and the pride of men humbled. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. How do you humble a tree or a mountain? It's a bit of a bizarre statement when you think about it. How will a tree be humbled or a mountain be humbled? Well, I was thinking a bit about this, and I guess there's two ways. Take a mountain, for an example. There's two ways you could humble a mountain. You could either completely flatten it down to sea level again, destroy the mountain, knock it down a peg or two, as it were. Or you could put something next to it which is far more greater, far more awesome than the mountain, and then the mountain will be humbled by the comparison between the mountain and that which is far greater. I used to go on holiday, or I still do sometimes, with my family in North Wales. And the town where we used to stay, there was a hill called Moelley Guest. Apologies for my Welsh pronunciation. I'll probably get ridiculed for that later. But it was quite an impressive mountain. It took us about an hour to get to the top, I guess. And it was pretty good. It looked quite impressive, I always thought. And then one year we went on, we were in holiday in North Wales again, and I was about 6 years old, I think, and we went to Snowdon, which obviously is much bigger than Moelley Guest, about four times the size, as it happens. I made it up to the halfway house and no further, and still haven't gone back to attempt the second half. But Snowdon humbles Moelley Guest. It's much more impressive than Moelley Guest. If they were next to each other, then Moelley Guest would look pretty unimpressive. But then put Snowdon next to Mount Everest. Mount Everest is eight times the size of Snowdon, which makes it, if my maths is right, about 32 times the size of little old Moelley Guest. Snowdon's so big that the oxygen levels at the top are one-third of the oxygen levels at sea level. It's claimed 179 lives of those who would dare to try and conquer it. I'm sure we've all seen aerial footage on television, perhaps of the Himalayas and the sheer rock faces and just the awesome size of the mountains that are there. Morley Guest is humbled by Mount Everest. But then compare Mount Everest with the splendour of the majesty of God that will be revealed for all to see on that day. Mount Everest will be humbled. The tallest of mountains will be humbled. God doesn't need to destroy a mountain to humble it. It's humbled by mere comparison to his splendour, to his awesomeness, to his majesty. And that is the glory that will be put on display for all to see on that day which is rushing towards us. It's not that God isn't like that now. God is just as glorious now as he will be on that day. But on that day, God will make it clear to everyone, he will show to everyone that he alone is to be exalted because he is that glorious. He is that wonderful. Every eye will see him. And it will be unmistakable that God alone will be exalted. But the second action that must take place is that everyone and everything else will be humbled. If God alone is to be exalted, then, well, everything else must surely be humbled, must be brought low. And this includes men, this includes us. Isaiah makes this clear, verse 11, "The eyes of the arrogant man will be humbled, and the pride of men brought low." Verse 17, "The arrogance of man will be brought low, and the pride of men humbled." Isaiah really rams this home. Men will be humbled on that day. The glory of men, the pride of men is fleeting. It will pass. We see that even within lifetimes, don't we? At the moment, the US election race is going on, isn't it? The first stages of that. And I saw the other day Bill Clinton on television with his wife, Hillary, who's obviously running in the elections. And this man, I was surprised to see, used to be the most powerful man in the world, could pretty much command anything to happen, and it would happen almost straight away. And now he's looking fairly old and frail. He still holds a position in the US Senate, but looking pretty old and frail and playing this kind of supporting role to his wife, who's now stepped into the limelight which he once occupied. And we can see within his lifetime that his glory has been fleeting. His pride, his power has passed. Perhaps a more extreme example, Muhammad Ali, from "I am the greatest" to suffering the pains and frustrations of Parkinson's disease. Within a lifetime, the glory of men passing, it's fleeting. And then beyond this life, well, we only have to think back a few weeks to a football match in Scotland over the Christmas period, where Phil O'Donnell, the captain of Motherwell FC, was applauded onto the pitch by over 5,000 fans, supporting the club that he'd always supported from a child. And then before the final whistle had even been blown, his glory snatched away in a moment. That day that is coming, that day which Isaiah sees, will bring the ultimate end to the pride and the glory of men who would cut God out of the picture and not acknowledge him as the one who alone will be exalted. Are you trusting in men this morning? Are you trusting in yourself, perhaps? Do you think that on that day you'd have a chance of standing before God? Do you think that on that day you deserve some acknowledgement for, well, the good things I've done, the kindness I've shown to people, the acknowledgement that I might have made of God to some extent? Well, The Bible says no. With respect and love, can I say that? That's foolishness to think that. Isaiah is so clear. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. No one else. No one else can stand in their own right, trusting in themselves. God alone will be exalted. And we must acknowledge that now. It includes man-made things as well. Man-made things will be humbled. These things which Israel gloried in, their silver and their gold, their chariots and their horses, those things won't last. They won't last forever. Verse 18, the idols will totally disappear on that day. Verse 20, Isaiah really drives it home. In that day, men will throw away to the rodents and bats their idols of silver and idols of gold, which they made to worship. Things that Israel had treasured and wallowed in and put their trust in, they'll disappear. They'll want to throw them away. They'll become worthless on that day. What worth are these things on that day? And what about us? Well, the day of the Lord, thinking about this day, it's such an antidote, isn't it? To having a wrong perspective on things, on stuff, on possessions. It really is a bit of a wake-up call. Do we need to transform our perspective on these things? I remember before Andy and Tatiana moved to Ukraine, I went to help them pack up some of the things in their house, which were being taken up to Andy's parents. And it was myself and Jeremy were there. I'll try and share a bit of the blame. But we were helping move this really quite smart-looking wardrobe, new wardrobe that Andy and Tatiana had in their house. And we were moving it downstairs. And geniuses that we are, we managed to break one of the feet on the wardrobe. And we were pretty distraught about it, I guess. And we were really worried about telling Andy and Tatiana about this. We really didn't want to tell them. We didn't know how they'd react. This really was quite a good wardrobe. And I remember eventually we plucked up the courage and I went to tell Tatiana, well, I'm sorry, we've broken your wardrobe. It's ruined. You can't really use it anymore. I don't think we can fix it. And I remember Tatiana's response. She said to me, well, don't worry. It's just things. It's just things. What a brilliant perspective. That's living in the broad perspective, with the true perspective. That's living in the light of this day that's approaching. It's just things. They're just things. They won't last forever. Don't worry about it. Are we taken up too much with things which are just things? Don't worry about them. They will become worthless on that day. It's something we need to work on, I guess, this area as Christians. I remember the other year I was at the FIEC conference and they have a question panel there every year at the end. Jonathan Stephen, who I guess lots of us would know of, was chairing it. And one of the questions he was asked to ask one of these impossible questions to answer, something along the lines of what's one of the biggest struggles facing the church today or something like that. I mean, how are you meant to answer that? And he probably just gave them one word to answer it in as well. But I was quite surprised by the response. I hadn't really thought about it before. He went along and there's people some of us would know on the panel, Roger Carswell and Sharon James and others. And their response was all the same. They all gave the same response. They all said materialism, 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 all along the road. And I was quite surprised. I mean, you could say other things. But that's what they chose to say. Do we need to work on this as God's people? If you're a Christian here this morning, is this something you need to think about, to work on? Are there steps that we can take to get a better perspective on things, on stuff? Maybe next time you give money to the church, write a number on the check that scares you. How about trying that? Or maybe before you write your shopping list or plan your weekend, then read a passage like Isaiah chapter 2 to get a bit of perspective. Maybe there's simple steps like that we could take. Why not think of things that you could do to get a better perspective on things? Here we are. That's the broad perspective, the true perspective. Men will be humbled. Man-made things will be humbled. God alone will be exalted on that day which is coming. Are we living in the light of that? Which perspective are you living with? The Israel perspective or the true, the broad perspective, which includes God? Why does it matter? Well, it matters because surely, well, it's nonsense, isn't it? If God alone will be exalted on that day, well, it's nonsense to live with the Israel perspective. If that day's really coming, well, it's foolishness. Again, I'd have to use that word. It's foolishness to live with any other perspective. Isaiah makes that point. Verse 22. Stop trusting in man who has but a breath in his nostrils. Of what account is he? Stop doing it. Stop trusting in man. Trust in God. Man is ultimately of no account. Don't trust in him. He's not dependable. He's not trustworthy on that final day. Only God is trustworthy. But more than that, it's Isaiah talks of the disaster that does await those who are not trusting God on that day, those who still trust in man. He talks of it being a day of fear, where people will flee from dread of the Lord, or hide in the rocks, or hide under crags in caves from the splendor of God's majesty when he rises to shake the earth. When God rises to shake the earth on that day, which category will you fall into? Those who are trusting in man or those who are trusting in God? Perhaps you've never thought about this before. Maybe you're not a Christian here this morning. You haven't heard these things before and you'd like an indication of a first step to take along this road of trusting God and living in this broader, this new perspective. Well, can I encourage you, the first step you must take, turn to Jesus Christ. Turn to him, trust in him, and have your sins forgiven by him who died to save you from your sins, if you will trust in him. That's the first step. It has to be the first step. Turn to him. Can I encourage you to do that this morning? Don't wait for that day which is fast approaching to come. Then it will be too late. Do it now. Glorify God now, because he will be glorified and he alone will be glorified on that day. Don't leave it till then to flee to the rocks and to the caves, but flee to Jesus Christ now and find refuge and safety in him. And if you're a Christian here this morning, well, we have so little time on this earth. That day will be upon us before we know it, won't it? And we can still be so foolish, can't we, with the way we live our lives. We can still go back to trusting man so often. Don't go back to that. Don't go back. Trust in God. Keep drinking this antidote of the day of the Lord. Keep taking it on board. Make sure your perspective is right every day. Be fed by this wonderful God-given antidote to a world which would tell us to trust in man. Don't do that. Trust in God. Boast in him. Glory in him and in nothing else, because the Lord alone will be exalted on that day.